This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the fourth week of May, and this week, relations really seem to break down between the president and Democrats in Congress again. It was supposed to be infrastructure week again, and Democrats came to the White House to discuss bipartisan deals with the president, including around infrastructure. But the meeting ended after 5 minutes. The president was offended that Nancy Pelosi had accused him of a cover-up surrounding the Russia investigation. So instead of having the meeting, he went out to give a speech in the Rose Garden about how unfair everyone was being to him. And as his administration continues to resist investigative efforts, Democrats are debating whether they ought to start impeachment proceedings, though Pelosi is pushing to hold off on that for now. We will discuss the impeachment push, both whether impeachment would be politically wise and whether it is constitutionally an obligation for the House in this circumstance, later in the show with Susan Hennessy from the Brookings Institution. But now, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
So, what else have we been watching this week? Liz, what's in the news for you?
Well, thousands of McDonald's workers went on strike yesterday to demand action on workplace abuses, including violence and sexual harassment. These fast food workers have proven to be on the vanguard of organized labor, coming together in the Fight for 15 living wage movement as well. And they've won, especially this time around, some real attention from 2020 Dems, with Bernie Sanders tweeting in support and using his notorious email list to call supporters out to the picket lines, and hopefuls like Jay Inslee, Julian Castro, and Bill de Blasio rallying with the strikers. Does this mean anything for the future of organized labor? Well, it might. Back in the run-up to 2016, when I was still writing for the New Republic, labor historian Rich Yazelson told me that unions are typically kind of cautious in the primary season, placing their bets on the candidate they think is likeliest to win, rather than the one who's necessarily the most friendly to labor. But with a lot of choices this time around, and organized labor making itself known in ways that it hadn't in the last couple of years, especially in the run-up to 2016, it looks like the unions might actually be able to get close with a candidate who really has their best interests at heart and is willing to fight for them, especially if instead of letting the bosses pick their endorsements, they actually let their members vote. And I think that's pretty exciting.
Rich, I look at this and I see this. It's not just happening in a political context. It's happening in an economic context. What we've seen happening in both the public sector and in the private sector is a lot of agitation for better wages, better conditions. And in this time where the labor market is tight, it's a good time to make those sorts of demands. And I think we've been seeing the labor side win a lot of these disputes in significant part because of how the economy is right now.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with jawboning, which this is an instance of it. These workers agitating and the Democratic candidates elevating their concerns. My worry are about minimum wage laws, which I think can have unintended consequences, and the legal dispute here over whether McDonald's is a joint employer or not, or whether it doesn't really have control over these independent operated restaurants. I have no idea who has the right end of that dispute.
Yeah, so Liz, that's, I think, a thing that has been important in the economy and sometimes under-discussed, that basically you have a lot of these changes in the way businesses are structured, where you have franchises or other things where you have the big, national, financially well-resourced company, and then you have local operations, and they can basically wash their hands and say, well, gee, that's what the franchisee is doing. We didn't tell them to do that. We have no control over them. We can't control the labor conditions there. So, and the labor law framework in the U.S., I think, is often built around that, where that sort of limits the ability of those employees to go to the big national corporation for relief. So what do you do about that besides these sort of public pressure campaigns that can say, well, you know, regardless of what the legal structure of the McDonald's corporation is, we're going to put a lot of public pressure on you?
I think it's definitely the case that labor law in the United States has been systematically weakened over a long period of time. And that's something that's badly in need of reform. And that's going to be in large part up to a new administration to kind of build energy around. I think that you see parallels between the sort of franchisee questions you see in the McDonald's case and almost Uber, where you have large, well-resourced national corporations, like you're saying, that then refer to what are obviously their employees as independent contractors who they're not responsible for. I would like to see the laws change to make those corporations who do make huge amounts of money off of these employees responsible for those employees' wages and benefits.
I think you see a weird relationship to these phenomena from President Trump, Rich, which is to say, you know, the president certainly likes to brag when wage growth is strong, but he also seems to have a lot of sympathy for employers who worry about costs, including labor costs. I mean, you've seen him out there saying in recent weeks that E-Verify, the system that would require employers to demonstrate that their workers are authorized to work in the U.S., that it imposes too much of a burden on them. He's pushed for more visas for low-wage workers. And you see the broader deregulation push and a lot of these pushes in the Department of Labor to roll back some rules in the Obama administration that, for example, would have made it easier for more workers to qualify for overtime. So he seems to, at the macro level, want to take credit for wages going up, but where he has policy levers, he doesn't seem interested in using them to benefit workers who earn wages.
Yeah, I don't think there's a strict contradiction there, but there's obviously a tension, and it goes just to the tension in Trump's economic policy we've talked about a lot, where the focus on wages is a new one for Republicans. I think it's a welcome one for Republicans, but it can take you in all sorts of kind of interesting and heterodox directions if you follow it through. Orrin Kass of the Manhattan Institute has written an entire book that basically follows those threads. But Trump is one, and Business Matters, kind of just typical Republican. Two, and Business Matters is an employer who, you point out, very much has the interests of employers at heart. And this just goes to one of the key contradictions in immigration policy as well. If you want to be a restrictionist and really have more enforcement, it doesn't have to do with bricks and mortars at the border. It has to do with squeezing off and cutting off the jobs magnet in the United States, which has to involve the government saying you can't hire illegal labor. And Trump has no interest in that because he's been on the other end of that equation and himself has employed cheap illegal labor for his own interests.
Liz, what do you see as the way to build on this momentum, which is to say, if you buy my thesis that labor is in cyclically a stronger position right now just because the economy is strong and the labor market is tight and it's a good time for workers to ask for things. That's not going to be true forever. How do you take the institutions that you're able to build up in this part of the economic cycle and use them at a time when the labor market is weaker?
I think that the 2020 Dems getting involved is a big part of that, which is to draw attention, to draw public support, to build a consistent, coherent narrative about organized labor sort of standing up for itself in a way that it hasn't been able to because of the condition of the economy over the past decade or so. I think that's how you really start to build momentum and give workers the confidence and courage they need to make these kinds of demands at a time when they're likely to have them answered.
Rich, what have you been watching this week?
Well, it was the most infrastructure week ever because I didn't even know it was infrastructure week until infrastructure week had already blown up. And I think kind of the legislative consequences of this latest episode are being exaggerated. I didn't think we were going to get an infrastructure program to begin with. The two sides are too far apart. Basically, on the top line number, Trump just likes saying big numbers, but there's no way Republicans in Congress would go for that number. And then how to pay for it. And I think now the pendulum on the conventional wisdom has swung a little bit the other way just because Trump says, oh, we're doing nothing, you know, we're not going to do a debt ceiling or we'll see about a debt ceiling. They're obviously going to have to do the things that are absolutely necessary, but they're not going to do any more than that.
Well, in fact, they got a disaster relief bill on the way to being done this week in a way that the president could have fought back against that. There were conservative Republicans in the House who wanted him to pick a fight, insist on more money for the border. And it seems that a day after the president said no more bipartisan deals, he cut one.
Right. I mean, it's another case where the bark is much worse than the bite.
Liz, what did you make of this episode at the White House?
I can never tell if Infrastructure Week is a real legislative phenomenon or if it's just a media joke. I think the line is increasingly thin between the two. And that's how it seemed this week. A lot of noise, not a lot of progress, and I'm not sure what the punchline is.
Rich, what do you think the president is so mad about? When he did this thing, I mean, we say, you know, Infrastructure Week is a media joke, but the president did call a meeting. He got these Democrats to come to the White House to talk with him about infrastructure. And then they had set up this podium in the Rose Garden with this graphic of, like, Mueller by the numbers showing, you know, Mueller spent X million dollars and Mueller had 18 angry Democrats and there was no collusion. I don't know why they didn't put zero collusion if it was supposed to be by the numbers. But so basically, they clearly had this plan that he was going to throw a tantrum and come out and give this speech and then send people on TV to say it hadn't been a tantrum and in fact, he was very calm. But so was it really that like Pelosi made this comment that he'd done a cover up and that's what he was upset about? Is it like I saw one thing in the background is that, you know, he really wants his trade deal with Canada and Mexico to go through. And now the big barrier is Democrats in the House or is it somehow that he sees political advantage in just showing himself standing up to the Democrats? Why this?
I'm not entirely sure. I think the simplest answer, though, is just that he doesn't like public criticism. And Nancy Pelosi said this right before the meeting. I do think, you know, we'll talk more about impeachment politics. I do think the idea that the main problem with the administration here is a cover-up is nonsense, because the investigation reached its collusion. don't let the president know I said that. Reached its conclusion, and a big report was written about it and was released and dropped into the laps of Congress to do with what they will. And because Pelosi doesn't want to impeach over that, she wants to make a big stink over these much less significant procedural matters.
Well, Liz, one of the dumbest aspects of an already dumb episode here was that there was this video circulating on the internet. Someone took a Nancy Pelosi press conference and slowed parts of it down so that it sounded like she was drunk or stumbling or something. And it's not even a good fake. It's a really obviously altered video. But then you had Fox News pundits talking about the video as though it were real. You had the president sharing the video on his own Twitter feed. I guess the question is, should we care? Like, is this just like another dumb thing the president does, or is this like an alarming thing where the president is sharing misinformation that is a personal attack on a political opponent?
I do think it's alarming. It's alarming in the technological context. Like you said, it wasn't a very convincing deep fake. It was more of a shallow fake. It was pretty obvious that it was manipulated in some way, but it still convinced some people who weren't out to be convinced, I have to assume, which does make it disturbing. And of course, it's disgusting and ridiculous. Trump is sharing it, along with incredibly hypocritical. This is the guy who couldn't say anonymous or origins. I wouldn't be targeting people for not being completely lucid in speech if I were Trump.
Rich, is there any, like, I think this is a thing that liberals look at and their heads explode. Like, this is just another norm of personal behavior that the president has no interest in following and that people have no interest in enforcing against him. And obviously, it's not the most important thing that he's ever done. But why is he allowed to behave like this?
Because no one can stop him, basically. I mean, every Republican in the Senate, with a couple exceptions, and even they have taken a step back, just knows they can say this is a bad, stupid, sophomoric thing that the President of the United States shouldn't do. And they're going to get a lot of grief over that from the president, from his supporters, from their own supporters, and nothing's going to change. So they've all implicitly just thrown up their hands.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back with Susan Hennessy from the Brookings Institution, who has some thoughts on whether the Congress is actually obligated to impeach here. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
If you're listening to our show, you're probably someone who appreciates all sides of an argument. So there's another podcast we think you should check out, Intelligence Squared US. America's leading debate series, they bring the most influential thinkers like David Brooks, Arianna Huffington, and Deepak Chopra together to debate contentious topics like free speech, the environment, and religion. It's not about soundbites and pundits, but a thoughtful, spirited competition of ideas. Find Intelligence Squared US wherever you get your podcasts. Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunick, columnist at The Washington Post. Well, as we discussed, this was not a great week for interpartisan relations, and it comes on top of a period after the release of the Mueller report where a lot of Democrats feel it's time to impeach the president, and a substantial number of Democrats in Congress have called for a formal impeachment inquiry into the president. The president himself has repeatedly stressed that he does not want to be impeached, but House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has found herself repeatedly explaining why she's not moving toward impeachment and even arguing that the president secretly would like to be impeached so that he can be a martyr. Among Democrats, the dispute is not so much over whether the president has committed an impeachable offense. Volume 2 of the Mueller report is devoted to an analysis of obstruction of justice and whether the president's actions in various episodes met the elements of the crime of obstruction of justice. You can argue over whether a prosecutor could bring a case and show the president had the requisite intent under the criminal statute to be convicted. But Congress isn't bound by criminal statutes. It gets to decide what's a high crime or misdemeanor for the purposes of impeachment, and Democrats, not to mention Michigan Republican Congressman Justin Amash, are convinced that standard is met. Still, just because you can impeach a president, does that mean you should? To discuss that, we're joined now by Susan Hennessy. Susan is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and the executive editor of the Lawfare blog. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
So, Susan, you've been writing that not only can Congress impeach here, but that the House has some sort of affirmative responsibility under the constitutional oath that members of Congress take in order to impeach here. Could you lay out why that is the case?
Right. So I'm not arguing that there is some sort of external trigger by which the House is compelled to impeach the president. Ultimately, it is a political judgment for members to make. You know, that said, members of Congress who enter into their office do swear an oath to well and faithfully discharge that office. And so I think whenever you're considering the question of impeachment, there's a little bit of confusion that happens in which people say, well, ultimately, it's a political judgment because, of course, it's a judgment for the political body. It's not something that the courts decide or that there's clear guidelines on. That's not the same thing as it being about purely politics. And so I think that the Constitution is quite clear, both expressly and structurally, that what it asks Congress to do as a matter of separation of powers is to consider under what circumstances the president is guilty of committing high crimes and misdemeanors, and determine whether or not impeachment is the appropriate remedy, whether or not the Constitution demands that action of their branch.
Wait, so I'm sorry. So if it requires them to determine whether that's appropriate, then couldn't they decide that it's not appropriate and not proceed with it, even if they believe that there has been a high crime or misdemeanor?
Right, so I wouldn't have any objection if what we heard from Democrats was, look, we looked at the Mueller report, and maybe there are some technicalities here, but we actually don't think that this is impeachable conduct at all. I think that's a defensible response, and more or less it is the response that we're seeing from Republicans, essentially that they don't believe that this conduct, either they don't believe it actually occurred, or they don't believe that it rises to that threshold. The problem in what we're hearing from congressional Democrats, particularly in the House, is a very clear articulation that they believe not just that the Mueller report describes impeachable conduct, but that it describes overwhelmingly impeachable conduct, and that, in fact, the president continues to behave to engage in behavior that is impeachable on an ongoing basis. And yet they are essentially refusing or being overwhelmingly resistant about pursuing that remedy, essentially because there is now an entrenched belief that somehow impeachment is going to end up benefiting the president politically. It's going to make him more likely to win re-election in 2020. I have sort of two objections to that argument. First, I actually don't know that political convenience is an appropriate consideration in impeachment at all. I believe that members of Congress are called to fulfill a higher duty. I also don't quite understand the evidence or argument for this idea that it actually would benefit Trump. I think that in some sense, the case that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has laid out really defies logic and common sense and certainly goes against the historic precedent that we have.
So, Liz, what do you make of that? Is there an affirmative obligation for the House to impeach if they believe that impeachable conduct was engaged in, especially if it was serious? Because I think a lot of Democrats look at this and basically say the president's poll numbers do not move on developments around the Russia investigation, which is an indicator to believe that more publicity and impeachment proceeding surrounding the Russia investigation would not be likely to further damage the president's numbers, reduce his likelihood of being elected, and that in fact it could have asymmetric effects on enthusiasm, that if you make him into a victim, that allows him to rally his base and helps him politically and helps him be reelected. And so that's a reason not to do it. And then the affirmative benefits, you know, normally you might think that impeachment is about removal, but it's not going to lead to removal of the president. So I think a lot of Democrats look at this and say, we don't think this is a useful exercise. We don't want to pursue it for that reason. We think there are better political strategies for opposing the president. Is that not an acceptable approach for them to take?
I think that if there were an obvious answer as to whether they had a legal obligation to pursue impeachment at this point, it would be clear and easy to cite. But I think that instead, a lot of this just comes down to judgment calls. And I think there is a judgment call being made on behalf of Democrats, where they have concluded that doing impeachment theater is just as useful to them and a lot less risky than actually trying to impeach Trump. That is, talking about impeachment, hinting at impeachment, constantly teasing impeachment, having all of these little side investigations and explorations into whether impeachment should be done or is possible. It interests their base. It excites their base. It looks like they're doing something, and it adds an element of stink to Trump because he seems like someone who's about to be impeached or deserves impeachment without actually putting Democrats through the political turmoil of beginning impeachment proceedings. So I don't think that there's a lot of innocence on the Democrats' part here.
Rich, when you look at what Justin Amash, the first Republican member of Congress to come out and say that the president should be impeached, what he says this week is he lays out a number of actions that the president took that he thinks are serious misconduct that rise to the level of impeachment. And these include telling FBI Director James Comey to lay off Michael Flynn, telling then White House counsel Don McGahn to have the special counsel removed from the investigation, using the prospect of pardons in an apparent effort to discourage witnesses from participating in the investigation. Is he wrong that this is the sort of thing that a president should be removed from office for? Because even if you take seriously the idea that Article 2 of the Constitution gives the president the legal authority to do some of these things, it seems like the Constitution also created the impeachment power as a remedy for those sorts of abuses of office.
Yeah, so his first tweet thread I thought was a little contradictory on this score because he took aim at Bill Barr and said Bill Barr's interpretation of the Mueller report is wrong and what he's saying about what we should do about impeachment is wrong, when Barr didn't do anything to address that. Barr made like the most minimal legalistic call, which is we're not going to prosecute this because it's unlikely a jury is going to find him guilty beyond reasonable doubt on this alleged offense, which has nothing to do with impeachment. Now, a crime could be an aggravating factor, right, and draw more attention, but you can impeach, he's right, just over an abuse of power. Where I just think this case is really ambiguous is there wasn't the underlying offense, the Russia collusion. As the obstruction volume goes on, it gets worse for Trump because I think I do buy the interpretation initially on Comey. He's upset that Comey won't say that he's not under investigation at a time when he's not under investigation for the Russia alleged Russia collusion. But as it goes on,
it's— get him off for asking him to lay off Flynn.
Well, it depends on is it lay off Flynn. Flynn, this guy's had a he's had suffered enough. Give him a break. And this is goes. Let me just finish the point, and I'll come back to that one. As the obstruction volume goes on, though, it's clear the president knows he's under investigation for obstruction. So it achieves this meta quality where I think the facts are much worse for him by the end than they are at the beginning, and the very worst being the alleged coaching of Don McGahn over this episode where Trump sort of ordered him to fire him. But this goes to another key ambiguity, which also applies to the Flynn case, is the president had the power to stop the investigation. He had the power to crimp the investigation. He had the power to stop people from testifying. And he didn't exercise any of that. And you get to this existential question that applies very often to Trump. It's applied a lot in foreign policy areas as well. What's a decision? What's an order? Is an order when he just says, Corey, go fire Jeff Sessions, right? Is that his order that shows, you know, he's guilty of obstruction? Or is the order vaporous because Corey says, look, Mr. President, I'm just some guy. I can't fire the attorney general. And the matter's dropped. And I think that's the sort of the key ambiguity of the whole thing. It's a damning picture of how he operates and obviously legitimate political fodder. I don't think it by any means mandates an impeachment.
But so, Susan, I suppose if we go back to what Amash is laying out there, which is basically arguing that in order to discharge its powers properly, that there ought to be not just an impeachment, but a removal of the president for this behavior. But suppose that you are a Democrat in the House and you know that the Senate is not going to remove if there's an impeachment referral. You don't even know if Mitch McConnell will agree to hold an impeachment trial in the Senate. It's not clear that there's any remedy if McConnell just says, well, they've impeached, but we're not holding the trial here. Or if they do hold the trial, they can turn it into a kangaroo court in all sorts of ways. If you're a Democrat and you look at this and you know that impeachment is not going to achieve removal, there are significant reasons to believe it's not even going to achieve the heightening of attention to what you see as the bad behavior by the president that you might hope to get out of impeachment. Why is there the obligation to go through the steps? If it's not going to actually hold the president accountable, why do you have to do it?
Well, I think a few things. First, I would pretty strongly disagree with Rich's characterization of what is actually in the report. And I think if you break it down, there is not actually a lot of ambiguity about the president's misconduct, his abuse of office, his lies to the American public, and criminal attempts to actually obstruct justice in ways that do not fall in that ambiguous sort of Article 2 category. But sort of setting all of that aside, I think we have to consider what it would say if based on the record that the Mueller report produces, Congress decided not to impeach because they didn't believe that they had the removal votes in the Senate. You know, impeachment is the way that Congress can enforce norms, right? Express what is tolerable and what is intolerable. It's a very blunt instrument. And one of the reasons why Robert Mueller decided not to render that traditional prosecutorial judgment in his report is because he was governed by this OLC memo, which determines that the president of the United States cannot be indicted. And so what Mueller said is, look, if the president can't be indicted, then I can't even accuse the president because it would be unfair for me to level this accusation in a situation in which the president can't have his day in court, can't defend his name. So under Mueller's read, a special counsel investigation can only exonerate the president. It can never actually accuse him. And if you go back to that original OLC decision, that memo determining that the president could not actually be indicted while in office, the OLC memo itself says, don't worry, this doesn't mean the president is above the law because there is a different remedy. There is the constitutional remedy of impeachment. And so if we fast forward and under this situation in which the Mueller report has, because of the OLC memo, declined to make the express accusation against the president, and the House of Representatives is saying, well, in the absence of that express accusation of criminality and the number of Republicans in the Senate, we aren't going to move forward even with an impeachment inquiry. I think what that says is the constitutional remedy actually is just a crude measure of vote counting. How many supporters does the president have in the Senate? And if that is true, then the entire rationale on which that OLC memo rests, the idea that, no, the president won't be above the law because of the existence of an alternative remedy, it falls apart. And we really do have a situation in which the president of the United States is practically, and for sort of all reasonable purposes, beyond the reach of the law. And I think that is an unacceptable outcome.
So, Liz, one thing Susan said in there is that impeachment is a blunt tool to enforce norms. And I guess that's the big question animating me here is, does an impeachment that we know is not going to lead to removal, does that actually enforce norms?
I mean, I think that you can envision a lot of unintended consequences spinning off that, which is something that we've been discussing from the Democrats' point of view, also some from the Republicans' point of view. I think it's very difficult to enforce a norm. I think once a norm needs enforcement, it's already disintegrated to the point where you're probably never going to get it back the way it was before. But what I would really like to see from Democrats on this is just action or a closed book, because I think the theater aspect of it is what's really wearing everyone out.
So what would that mean? You think they should either impeach or stop investigating?
Right. Impeach or say definitively through Schumer and Pelosi et al., we're not going to begin impeachment proceedings. We just don't have it, and it's not going to be that way.
I'm surprised there's not more discussion of censure vote, which is a way to rebuke the president, make the House's displeasure with his conduct clear without dragging the country through, or their more vulnerable moderate members through an impeachment proceeding.
So, Susan, when you talk about that, if this, you know, if impeachment is just a vote counting exercise, then the OLC memo is absurd. What if the OLC memo is absurd? What if the answer here is that impeachment is not an effective remedy beyond a political remedy for holding the president accountable? And the problem is this decision that a president can't be indicted. Maybe the solution does need to be back in the Department of Justice.
Yeah, so I actually would agree with that. I don't think that the OLC opinion is constitutionally sound, although I do think it's defensible. I think it's sort of an area in which reasonable minds can disagree. The problem with the situation we're in is that there's actually no forcing function to actually test the constitutionality of that OLC judgment. Because OLC guidance is binding on the Department of Justice, and because the Department of Justice is the only body capable of criminally indicting someone in this country, there's actually no mechanism to determine whether or not that guidance is right or wrong unless the president voluntarily decides he wants to reevaluate the question. And so I don't think that would be a bad outcome, right, to reevaluate the OLC memo. The problem is that memo is the universe in which we currently live. And so I think Congress has to accept that it really is the body that has the responsibility and that this is a responsibility the Constitution of the United States vests in it, right? That this question of impeachment, the founders thought a lot about which body should consider this question. They thought about giving it to the Supreme Court. They decided that the House of Representatives was the right body to essentially bring the accusation, the charge. And I think it's important to keep in mind, we're talking about an impeachment inquiry, the process of fact-finding leading to an eventual impeachment, and that that the Senate would be the body deciding whether or not they wanted to convict. And so I think that is the world which the House of Representatives needs to be responding to in determining whether or not, taking this course of action is appropriate or not.
Rich, does this broadly not worry you at all? Which is to say, if you think that the president's behavior, while bad, doesn't rise to the level of an impeachment, suppose it were worse and it were enough that you would feel that he ought to be impeached. Do you believe that the House of Representatives would do that and the Senate would remove him if his poll numbers continued to be around where they are with 90% support from Republicans? Does it worry you that there is no accountability mechanism that works for a president who breaks laws?
The ultimate accountability mechanism is an election, and impeachment is there for radical, severe cases. So I would argue that when Barack Obama rewrote immigration law on his own, that was an impeachable offense. When Trump said, "I can spend money, without congressional authorization on a wall," that is an impeachable offense. But since no one really agreed with me and no one felt them as that severe a defamation of our political order, they're just not going to be impeached. So it has to be something that's really shocks the conscience of everyone. And
so was perjury in a civil case deposition, as Bill Clinton did, was that the sort of severe crime that rises to the standard you're laying out here?
I think Republicans, they had the same sort of discussion that Democrats have had now. Some of them, it's we have no choice. It's our duty. We do it, or at least we have the inquiry and public opinion changes. And none of that happened. And it really acted as a vote of censure. And retrospect, that's probably what we would have been better off doing.
I think it's actually important to note the procedural significance of an actual impeachment inquiry rather than something like just a vote of censure. And that's that the president has been quite open in this stonewall strategy. He says we're going to fight all the subpoenas, essentially refusing to recognize oversight at all or the power of Congress to conduct oversight at all. And actually, the Congress is in a much stronger legal position to the extent that they do have to end up litigating all of their subpoenas at court. They are they're in a far stronger legal position if they actually have an impeachment inquiry that puts that very, very clear legislative purpose on the table than if they were doing something like other forms of investigation or censure motions. And so I actually think that it is as a procedural matter, it's actually important to be honest about what they're doing here. And to Liz's point, to either decide that they're going to commit and go down this path or affirmatively say we aren't doing it. But sort of this playing of both sides, I actually think is inflicting additional sort of substantial harms on the nation because we aren't going to be able to get the answers to these really important questions.
Liz, it kind of feels to me like an impeachment inquiry is Chekhov's gun, which is to say, if you can't start the impeachment inquiry and then not impeach because we've already done so much of the fact-finding and Democrats already believe, I think with good ground, that there is an impeachable offense here. So if that's the thing you're looking for in the impeachment inquiry, you're going to find it.
Right. If it's there and you think it's serious and in some sense you already have it, then go forward with it. I think that's one of the risks that Democrats run in continuing to sort of publicly deliberate on whether or not to begin impeachment proceedings is the public is going to begin to feel like if you have the material you need, which you're constantly airing, why don't you move forward with it? If you're not moving forward with it, it must not be what you say it is. So I think there are several risks that come with simply putting off impeachment proceedings in favor of having a kind of public theater of impeachment. And I think that we're really starting to get to a sort of critical point there.
I actually disagree with that. I guess I'm the only person who likes this theater strategy. But basically, I think that, I think that ultimately the political limitation is the Senate is not going to remove. And I think that this stuff has been aired so publicly and people have already formed their opinions about it. They formed their opinions about it before there was even so much information publicly, although now there is. And so I don't think we have to worry that, Democrats are going to start to come under the impression that the president really didn't do such a bad thing and that's why they're not impeaching. And I think you do get these people, on Twitter, who are, they're very angry that the impeachment hasn't happened, and they warn that, you know, Democrats are going to be demoralized if you don't impeach. I think the sort of people whose primary engagement with politics right now is around Russia and Mueller and these sorts of things are the most engaged voters out there. Those people, they loathe and fear Donald Trump, in some cases for perfectly good reasons. They are going to crawl over broken glass to go vote in 2020, and so I don't worry about the political effects from that. And so I think Democrats are in a strong position to sort of use this as, you know, as something that's politically damaging to the president. I think they're in a very weak position to actually get him removed, and that's why I've been skeptical about the impeachment bit. Rich, did you have something small before?
Susan's point that an impeachment inquiry makes the House's legal case stronger in these various privilege fights may be true, but what Pelosi realizes politically, this is the key juncture. And if she approves an impeachment inquiry as just another step, you know, down the path to see where it leads, they're going to impeach him because they're not going to come away from an inquiry and say, oh, yeah, it all, everything checked out, you know, everything was fine. And this is the absurdity, I think, of the theater, you know, may make political sense. It's just everything is there. It's been written down by Bob Mueller. It's all there for them to make their decision or not. They could slap an afternoon panel of constitutional experts and former prosecutors up to do some testimony, impeach him the next afternoon if they wanted to, but Nancy Pelosi doesn't.
So I do want to push back a sort of a quick point on this. You know, last week we had an entire news cycle dedicated to this revelation about Michael Flynn having a voicemail from one of Donald Trump's lawyers. It drove the news cycle for a day. That was information that was actually contained in the Mueller report. And so this idea that the American public or even, frankly, members of Congress have fully reckoned with or digested this 450-page report, I just think is factually untrue. And so I think that to the extent impeachment inquiries are necessary to dig into that report, to force the American people to confront what it says, and ultimately to hand it over to the Senate. And if Republicans in the Senate do not want to vote to convict the president, then that's their prerogative to do so. But I don't think it's unreasonable to demand that they record that vote for history and they be held accountable to that choice.
Susan Hennessy is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and executive editor of the Lawfare blog. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Still with me are on the left, Liz Brunig of the Washington Post, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
Well, this might be my worst pick for Tweets of the Week ever, because it's not just a visual, a GIF or something. It's a song.
Oh, great.
From this University of Texas kid who tweets at Thus Tweets David. And it's his take on Frank Sinatra's Fly Me to the Moon. And it's so wonderful and sweet. I watched it about five times as of a couple days ago. It had 2.3 million views. If you haven't yet come across it, go out of your way to do so.
Liz Brunig, what's your tweet of the week?
I'm disappointed you didn't sing it for us, Rich.
Yeah, that's what I was expecting.
I tried it for my wife. It did not work out very well.
So my tweet is from Jennifer Brett. It's actually a Twitter thread on the retirement of Floyd Martin, 35 years a mailman. The tweet thread details Floyd's career, his relationships with his loyal letter senders and receivers, and the love that can blossom in an ordinary mailbox given enough time and care. Plus, it honors a truly great institution, the USPS.
My tweet of the week is from Resistance Bro Brian Krasenstein. He tweets, "While many of you are yelling, 'Go Rams' or 'Go Patriots,' I'm yelling, 'Go Robert Mueller and the rule of law.'" Now, that tweet might sound weird since the Super Bowl was in February, and indeed the tweet is from February, because my tweet of the week is something of a Twitter obituary. Brian Krasenstein and his brother Ed are no more. I mean, they're not dead, but they are banned from Twitter forever, accused of running fake accounts and paying for engagement with their tweets. They did have a good run. The extremely thirsty Resistance Brothers managed to be the top reply to so many presidential tweets, telling their hundreds of thousands of followers what a bad man he is. They even produced a children's book called How the People Trumped Ronald Plump, in which shirtless strongman special prosecutor Robert Morrill saves the world. In fact, I'm pretty sure Michael Avenatti is really just the two brothers, with Brian standing on Ed's shoulders under a trench coat. I could never figure out what it was the Krasensteins were up to. It always seemed like it had to be about making money, but I couldn't figure out how they were, so maybe it was just a hobby. But anyway, now it's over. Krasensteins, I don't know how we will stand up to Donald Trump without you. I've been talking with Liz Brunig of the Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We'll be back with Tyler Cowen to talk about why he loves big business. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunick, columnist at The Washington Post. They say nobody likes big business. A 2016 Gallup poll found only 18% of Americans say they trust big business a great deal or quite a lot. That was a worse rating than the police, the church, organized labor, television news. Better than Congress, though, at least. But maybe it depends how you ask the question. When Georgetown University does its own survey on confidence in institutions, major companies do okay. People seem to like the term major companies better than big business. And if you ask about specific major companies, they can do really well. Georgetown found Amazon and Google are two of the most trusted institutions in America, ranking only behind the military. And that disconnect gets at an argument our next guest makes in his new book. Tyler Cowen is an economics professor at George Mason University and director of the Libertarian Mercatus Center. His new book is called Big Business, A Love Letter to an American Antihero. Welcome, Tyler.
Hello. Thank you.
So your book is about how big business is a really good thing. So what do you think the public skepticism of big business gets wrong?
I think if you look at the ordinary American public, their actual behavior, they're relatively trusting of big business. If they order something from Amazon, they think it will come in 2 days. But our intellectual class, segments of our media, big segments of our political class, essentially have decided to villainize big business and turn against it for their own reasons.
And so what are those reasons?
If it's the case of the media, well, Facebook and Google are major competitors with newspapers, and I think they're resented for outcompeting newspapers. If you look at Donald Trump, he loves to tweet against CEOs such as Jeff Bezos, but on the left you have Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders pushing an agenda of socialism. And I think in general, for American intellectual elites, big business is a rivalrous source of influence and wealth and just general social status, and there's a good deal of resentment. Intellectuals think they should be paid more.
Liz, what do you make of this? Is there a groundswell of support for big business out there that elites are fighting against?
I have no idea. I mean, we talked about different types of polling. I think when people say they mistrust big business, they're not typically referring to doubts that the businesses are going to deliver the products they say they're going to deliver. I think they're typically referring to the role that big business plays in society and specifically politics. I do think that there is a sense among ordinary people that big businesses intrude more and more into the socio-political realm in places that they're unwelcome and exert undue power that individuals themselves have a hard time exerting.
Yeah, so Tyler, as I read your book, I sort of thought some of this might be a category error almost, that basically, I mean, you talk about all the things that big business delivers for people, and then you also talk some about sort of the inevitability of big business, that people, you know, even when they have policy ends that are on the left, they rely on businesses as instruments to deliver them. But if businesses are sort of inevitable, doesn't it make sense to talk critically about big business, even if we think that it's something that we would be worse off not having at all, that, you know, it's here, it's going to be part of our society, we need to hold it accountable, we need to make it better, we need to make sure that it is used as a tool for ends that are good for ordinary people?
America arguably has the world's best business culture. We're more motivated to go into business, we're more motivated to do startups or to try to innovate. We're in danger of losing that by lowering the status of big business. And there's a myth going around that somehow big business controls the government. If you look at the actual federal budget, more and more of the money is being spent on the elderly. I wouldn't say big business has nothing to do with that, but that is largely voter-driven, and that, in essence, Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg, they are not controlling our destinies through politics.
Rich, what do you make of the rising skepticism of big business from some figures on the right, not just the president? You're also seeing people in Congress.
Yeah, Josh Hawley gave the senator from Missouri gave his maiden speech on the Senate floor just recently. It's very interesting, but has a more populist orientation on these issues than Republicans traditionally have. I think Tyler, I find his arguments very compelling. I don't think bigness itself is a problem. I think it has a lot of advantages. The problem is if you have monopolistic or predatory behavior, and that's the big aspect of the debate about big tech is, are these companies serving the consumer, so sort of passing our traditional monopoly test or antitrust test at the same time they're engaging in sharp practices that are unhealthy for the entrepreneurial environment and at the end of the day are going to be bad for the consumer.
Yeah, Tyler, what do you make of some of these criticisms of the big tech companies from the right that they're, you know, people say that they're unfair to conservatives, but then you also have broader complaints than just about, you know, whose comments are getting taken down on Facebook, about ideas that having such a strong position in something like social networking or search gives these companies strong, almost government-like influence over the discourse.
Those companies have an incentive to appeal to a very broad number of users. If you look at Facebook, Donald Trump spends more on Facebook than other political candidates do. The media outlet, which has had its articles magnified the most by Facebook, actually is Fox News. I think that's a big reason why the left often doesn't like Facebook. There's a sense of we're losing control of the narrative. The right, I think, has gone somewhat hysterical. They're too worried about deplatforming. There are some bad instances of that. But for the most part, there are way, way more platforms than ever before, and that is because of big tech, and a lot of those platforms are there available for free.
Yeah, so, Liz, that's more or less the talking point we've tended to hear from the big tech executives themselves, that what they've built is a big open ecosystem, that there's more discussion than ever, and that people shouldn't worry too much about the idea that they have power because the discussion has become more democratized. What do you make of that?
Well, not all the platforms are created equal, right? So there are a lot of different platforms out there that you can use, but they're not all going to pack the same punch. I don't tend to worry about deplatforming too terribly much, but I do see the reason that people feel like it's an exhibition of undue power. And it is. It is an exertion of power. I think alongside tech giants just deplatforming people or banning types of speech they don't like, you also see quite a bit of control over free speech from companies themselves, which can look at what their employees are saying on social media, for instance, off hours and fire them because of it. There have been many such cases, as our president likes to say. In that sense, big business becomes the police of free speech. Even if what you're saying isn't illegal, you can still lose your livelihood over it.
Yeah, Chris Hughes, one of the founders of Facebook, had a big op-ed in the New York Times a couple weeks ago that got a lot of attention, arguing for the breakup of Facebook. I didn't find the breakup argument very compelling because basically what he was just talking about was cleaving off Instagram and WhatsApp, which are acquisitions Facebook have made. But Facebook would still be there and a really big influential thing, even if you took those services away. And I think the services have been good for consumers, the way Facebook has run them. But the thing that did give me pause, it goes to Liz's point. Chris Hughes points out that Facebook was being used to post messages that were supposedly driving ethnic conflict and potential genocide in Burma. And Mark Zuckerberg's told about this. And he's like, let's shut down those messages. And he says, well, if he has that power to do that in a foreign country, why doesn't he have the power to do that here as well? And isn't that too much power for any one person to have?
Yeah, Tyler, when you look at the public opinion polling on these things, when you look at that Georgetown survey, you find people have a lot of confidence in Amazon and in Google. Facebook rates quite poorly there. And so it seems to me like people say big tech, that can obscure differences among these companies. I think there's a better argument that Facebook has made some questionable choices in the use of its power. But also with Google, there's the countervailing aspect that Google provides us all these useful things, you know, maps and search and documents and all these things. It's less clear that Facebook is actually useful or whether it's just something that's making us miserable.
There's a recent study that estimated the consumer surplus from Facebook was $231 billion, or often about $1,000 per user. That's phenomenally high. Few other businesses can claim the same. If I think of my wife, who grew up in the Soviet Union, she uses Facebook to keep in touch with her friends in Maryland, also from the same part of the world. And she's part of a community, also a face-to-face community, and manages that because of Facebook. So it has incredibly high value to a lot of people.
So Liz, when you go back to, you said you don't think that people are concerned that companies aren't going to sell the products that they say they're going to. I think people do worry about that in a lot of sectors. I think that people think that financial products and healthcare products and various other things are often overpriced, not designed in a way that is designed to benefit the consumer. When you look for comparison at Amazon and how it does so well in some of these surveys, I think it is what Tyler's pointing to, which is that Amazon says the thing's going to be at your house in 2 days, and then it is. It's an institution that keeps its promises at a time when when a lot of others don't. And so I guess the question is, when you look at least some of big business, isn't that a thing that, that counts in its favor that people should look at, that there's a strong incentive for these companies, especially when it really is the consumer's direct money being spent on the product without the government or some other payer intermediating, that really creates an incentive for them to do what they say in a way some other institutions don't?
What other institutions do you have in mind?
Well, I think people are often concerned that, you know, that religious institutions, the government, certain social institutions are not delivering what they are expected to.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely incentives for institutions that peddle in products to peddle products. Institutions like religious institutions that deal in life after death, for instance, have a much harder time making the case that they're delivering because people don't tend to come back from the dead and talk about it. But I think, again, that a lot of the mistrust, especially on the left, issues from the role that these businesses play in government. And it's not strictly in payments to politicians in terms of campaign donations, right? That's much too limited of a scope. These businesses spend lots of money donating to think tanks. They fund industry groups that advocate for their interests. They fund think tanks that are essentially fake little research centers that try to create information that makes their products or their practices look better than they really are. This is especially the case for tobacco and chemical companies. They buy economics departments, and from those economics departments often spring federal appointees or judicial appointees that then have a role in politics, and they get their prominence and their prestige from these businesses funding their departments and their titles. There are so many ways that businesses exert undue influence over politics. And I have to think, at least on the left, that's where a lot of this suspicion and skepticism is coming from of how big businesses function in society. And I think it's warranted.
So, Tyler, doesn't that worry you at all? I mean, if you say that you think the status of big business should be raised in the United States, wouldn't if we make it more likely that people trust big business when it proposes things or asks for things, that, for example, you could get more crony capitalism, you would have businesses have more success getting government to do things that are good for them rather than necessarily good for the general public?
I'm against crony capitalism. I think it's often overestimated how much of it we have. If big business were quote-unquote in charge, we wouldn't have Donald Trump right now. Big business, on average, tends to favor predictability, relatively open trade, a pretty high degree of immigration, a not-too-tough regulatory environment. In my view, those are mostly good things. If you look at the Federal Register, it's quite clear that is not being run by big business. I do think there are parts of our economy we should regulate more tightly, most of all carbon emissions. But if big business had more political influence, we actually would get a lot of benefits from that.
Tyler Cowen of George Mason University and director of the Mercatus Center. His new book is Big Business, A Love Letter to an American Antihero. Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Bernie Sanders knows just what urban kids in the worst school districts in America need: more government command and control. His education plan would crimp charter schools that have had amazing success in places like Boston, Newark, and New York, in an attempt to keep as many kids as possible in terrible but heavily regulated public schools. But who cares about the interests of poor urban kids when you have a socialist ideology to push?
Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
Back in mid-May, a World Bank employee traveling on the D.C. Metro noticed a uniformed Metro employee eating on the train. The World Bank employee confronted the Metro employee, was told in other terms to mind her own business. That didn't sit well, so she photographed the Metro employee, angrily tweeted the D.C. Metro's Twitter account, demanding accountability and a response. Story still playing out with repercussions for the nosy photographer and statements issuing from the Metro Employees Union. But if there's a lesson in all this, I think it's don't be a hall monitor just for the sake of it. Alert authorities when people are breaking rules in a way that harms you or others or puts people at risk, but don't tattle out of annoyance or the temptation of assuming a role with authority. It just doesn't add to the greater good.
For my rant, Michael Avenatti has been indicted for, among other things, forging Stormy Daniels' signature to steal part of her book advance. I'm not going to pretend as though Michael Avenatti was ever a leading contender for the Democratic presidential nomination. He had his fans. They mostly didn't want him to be president, but they did love him, and they loved the way he fought Trump. And I think there was this idea that you need a Trump-like figure to take on Trump. Well, we've seen what a Trump-like lawyer does. He lies and he vents on television and he steals clients' money to spend on his auto racing team. Trump's faults are false. He is unpopular. He gets in the way of his own policy agenda. Seeking figures who emulate him is not good strategy, good morality, or good aesthetics. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, Susan Hennessy, and Tyler Cowan. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Berskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.